If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Granddad Business with Aaron Caliber.
That's my dad.
Hello!
Underpants?
That is hilarious.
Shut your mouth, dude. Rate and review this podcast or my daddy will go into a deep depression.
Granddad Business with Aaron Caliber.
Yeah. Boom. Welcome to Grown Dad Business. This is Aaron Kleiber. So today I have a great beginning of a two-part podcast with legendary comedian, comedy club booker, Eddie Brill. Eddie Brill worked on The Late Show with David Letterman as an audience warm-up for a long time. And for about 17 years, he worked for the Letterman Show, and he was the stand-up booker for 11 years at the Letterman Show. Really cool. He runs the Great American Comedy Festival in Johnny Carson's hometown. It's really the Johnny Carson Great American Comedy Festival, and we kind of broke it into two parts because there's so much to get into. Just, I mean, talking about his comedy career and growing up as, you know, a big brother, raising, you know, multiple siblings, and it's really awesome talking to these, you know, comedians who have been around for so long and have seen so many things in their life and comedy, and their family affecting their career is just fascinating to listen to. And also we talk about him meeting his son for the first time when he was 13 years old, not Eddie, but his son was 13. He didn't know he had a son. It's just amazing. But It's a pretty cool episode. So, you know, stick around, wait for next week for the second part. And it's a pretty awesome, I had an amazing experience talking to Eddie Brill. But if you're listening, this weekend, I am in Houston, Texas, with my friend Harlan Williams at the Houston Improv. And then March 14th and 15th, I'll be in Austin, Texas. Might be doing some shows on the 14th, Monday the 14th and the 15th in Austin, Texas during South by Southwest. And then I will be at the Tulsa Looney Bin March 16th through the 19th. And then, you know, I got some shows in Pittsburgh. March 24th, I'm on my friend Matt Light's show, Lights Out, at the Pittsburgh Improv. And then I have Comic Wars March 26th at Arcade Comedy Theater. And, you know what to do, guys. Come on, you're grown-ups here. You know how to go on the internet and go to AaronKleiber.com and see what's cracking. And also my movie review podcast with my friend Sean Collier, movie critic, legitimate movie critic and comedian Sean Collier. You Can't Handle the Truth, handlethetruthpodcast.com. And quick shout out to my sponsor. It's not my sponsor. It is my sponsor because it's my friend and my sponsor. Well, he's my friend now because I love his product. It's goodsandevil.com. Amazing movie, horror, nerd shirts. Also has a line of vegan shirts if you're into that. I'm into meat, but some people aren't. And if you're not into meat, they have some awesome vegan goods at goodsandevil.com. So check those guys out. But with further ado, is that what you're supposed to say? It's my friend Eddie Brill. Boom. Welcome to Grown Dad Business. Hi, it's me, Aaron Kleiber. I have a really fun guest today. I'm very excited to have. Just really, I mean, you know, you can't look somebody in the eye and be like, it's a legend of comedy. And
you can't look me in the eye.
But really, I mean, you know, when you really look at what this guest has done, I mean, you really have helped really move comedy along in history. It's Eddie Brill, guys. Say hello to Eddie Brill.
Yeah. People are actually saying hello. Yeah.
They do. They do, like from their car.
Hello.
So, for those of you who don't know, Eddie Brill has been doing stand-up how long?
A long time. You know, I started in the 70s, late 70s in college, and then I quit in 1980, and then I started again in 84. So, in a row, it's almost 32 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a row. But I had done it a handful of times while I was in college. I started in a comedy group in college.
Yeah.
And one of our friends in college was Stephen Wright.
Yeah.
And he was doing stand-up, and we would go watch him. And then we tried it, the bunch of us in the comedy world. And yeah. And we liked it, but we weren't as good as him. He was really great, yeah. great.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, I looked you up. I did research because this is a professional show.
Yeah, I could tell.
You were the stand-up booker and warm-up on David Letterman's Late Show.
Yeah, I worked there for 17 years. I booked for 11. Wow. But I've been booking comedy in some fashion for over 30 years. I started a comedy club in New York, and I would book it.
Yeah.
And ran it as a comic, and I made it very comic-friendly. I paid very well. Made sure that the comics were treated really well.
Yeah.
And I also, like, built a room for comics to hang out in. And then, you know, it's just my whole life I've fought for comedians behind the scenes.
Yeah, and that's, and now you do work with the Great American Comedy Festival.
Yes.
That's basically the Carson Comedy Festival, right?
I've been, again... you know, behind the scenes, I worked with the Aspen Comedy Festival and the Dallas Comedy Festival and the Vancouver Comedy Festival and the Woodstock Comedy Festival. I've helped a lot of festivals get off the ground and be there. I wanted to run a comedy festival that would honor Johnny Carson, but at the same time, really be incredible to comedians. You don't charge them for submitting. In fact, you don't really submit, like with you or with anybody. People say, well, I recommend this comedian.
Right.
And that's how the best comics in the world are usually gotten from the other great comedians. And also the best club bookers, and there are lots of them, despite what people think, will tell me, hey, I'm going to put a showcase together. I'm going to give you 12 of the best people who have come through my room.
Right. So and some festivals work like that, too, where it's... You know, we are sitting here at the San Luis Obispo Festival.
Yes.
And, you know, I've had comedian and industry friends say, you should do that festival. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll get in.
Yes.
You know, it's not shady.
No, not at all.
Comedians listening. But it's, you know, it definitely ensures them that they get a good crop of comedians.
Yeah, I've enjoyed, you know, I see so much comedy and sometimes too much. And you just, you know, unless it's Bob Newhart or some show that I want to see, I can't sit through every comedian. But I've really enjoyed the shows here because there's so many great comedians and a lot of comedians I've never seen before.
Yeah, it's fun, too, because when for me... You know, when you come to a festival like this, you come and see a bunch of comedians that are on your level some way. So it's like, oh my gosh, there's no open micers here complaining. Like, we're all still complaining.
Yeah, of course.
But it's like, oh, whoa, we're all going through the same thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like a recovery group. Like, we're all here together. Like,
yeah. And I think that's good for
you
us.
You can't
as
get
comedians.
That show either. Me neither.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's fun. Yeah. No, I immediately found it really interesting that you have this history of kind of trying to essentially what you're saying with that club in New York and like the festivals. And it's kind of close to my heart is that you, I'm from Pittsburgh and I also am like a dad comedian.
Right.
Hello, this is the name of the podcast because I have three kids.
But hello.
I mean, people are like, kind of call me like the dad of Pittsburgh comedy and things. And I come from a counseling and ministry background. Oh. So it really resonated with me that you kind of created things for comedians. You know, like you started like a school or something.
Well, it was
some stuff I read.
Yeah, well, I went to Emerson College and we formed a comedy group, and there was a lot of very good improv comedy actors who became great comedians in that group. And before us, there were a lot of great comedians like Andrea Martin and Jay Leno and on Norman Lear in production wise. But there wasn't really a comedy. You didn't go there for comedy.
Right.
So we created, Norman Lear had. I'd met him, talked to him about our comedy group. He said, hey, what do you guys need? I told him what we needed. He came up with the money. The school matched it. And we had a comedy program at the school, which was great.
Right.
And then guys like Bill Burr, who's, I think, one of the greatest comics on the planet, and David Cross.
My favorite.
And Laura Keitlinger. Yeah. And Jennifer Coolidge. And on and on. All these incredible people started coming to Emerson College to study comedy. And now, this year, there's a major in comedy there.
It's crazy.
So it's pretty cool to look back to when I met Norman Lear, I guess 1978.
Yeah.
And so I recently saw him for the first time since then and had breakfast with him. And I said, you know, what we did a long time ago is paid off in a really great way. And he went, I don't even remember that. He said, but I'm glad that I'm part of it.
It is kind of fun. And, because we're talking about this, I never want to, because when I started comedy in Pittsburgh, there wasn't much going on. And, you know, now 7 years later, we have, you know, I'm on the board of a comedy theater that's, you know, Arcade Comedy Theater that I always talk about.
Yes.
because it's kind of like my home club. I mean, it's downtown Pittsburgh.
Right.
Arcade Comedy Theater. I'm on the leadership board, and, you know, I book all the stand up there. And so 7 years later from when I started, we have a Black Box Comedy Theater that have classes. I just had Todd Glass there and Dean Del Rey. And, you know, I get my friends to come in to play this little Black Box Comedy Theater that never exists. I mean, it's just, it's nuts.
Yeah, well, that's what's great about the arts. You create something from nothing. You have a blank canvas and you create it. A lot of people paint by numbers. The biggest group of people paint by numbers. They do what's been done before.
Right.
Exactly. And they're just filling in the same colors that's already in the slots. But when you create something that's brand new, you know, from a blank canvas, and all of a sudden you see it come to fruition, it's very, very rewarding.
Yeah. And it's just neat to see that, like, from when I started, you know, I was like, well, there's not much time to get up and I want to get better.
Right. That's the only way to get better.
So I started two mics like that.
That's
like
the way to do it.
6 months in. And started a showcase at the Improv. And, you know, and then, you know, a couple, you know, Arcade's been going on for 3 years. And when they started that, my whole background's in improv. So all my improviser friends were like, well, we're opening a comedy theater. You're our stand-up guy.
Ah.
You know? So, and now we have classes and, you know, and there's other classes going on in town.
And you know what's interesting about classes is in acting, classes are very important. Workshops, I was just, you know, Dustin Hoffman is an example, but I was trying to think of who I can't think of his name. He plays the president on Netflix on the
Kevin
show.
Kevin Spacey.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, and he was just talking in England, had a big chat about the workshops and the theaters that he's done. Now, stand-up comedy, a lot of people are like, hey, you can't teach comedy. Don't tell me, you know, I'm not taking a fucking class from someone who's a, you know, someone who's a beginner. But I believe that. I believe that you can't teach comedy.
And we all know some stand-ups have ruined it.
Yeah.
For, you know, but that's everything.
Yeah. Some, you know, guys who sell sausages and
University
carts
of Phoenix.
Have ruined it
Hello.
For other carts, sausage guys, because they have shitty sausages. But there are incredible workshops, and I've been doing one for like 19 years all around the world. I'm very proud of it, and I've grown doing it, and I have a lot of people doing it. But everyone thinks, well, it's only for young comics, and only young comics are going to be foolish enough. Or even some people have said, well, you book Letterman, and these people are taking these workshops to try to get on Letterman.
Right.
And first of all, people who were, I would tell people at the beginning of every workshop, this is not a Letterman audition. This is a different game, a different fun day, and all this kind of stuff. Well, anyway, the best workshops I've ever done, the best one I've ever done was in San Francisco with all the classic comics who've been doing it 18 years and up. Everyone just traded ideas with each other.
That's
great. Each other's eyes and ears.
Yeah.
And I think that, I believe that that's really important for comics to be able to. Like last night, I saw a bunch of great comics. I saw Chris Fairbanks for the first time, really saw him.
Oh, my gosh. I love that
guy. He made me laugh. And Sam Tripoli, who I've seen since he's very young, because I met him through my son, speaking of children. And, you know, he was inspirational last night.
Yeah.
For me, I love stand-up more than any job I've ever done.
Yeah.
And to be here and to have to bring your game up to match all these great comics. Then I see these young guys come up, and they're just talking from the heart, and they just give it their all, and I'm like, okay, it inspires me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun, that process, and I like that about you, that, you know, because like I was saying about Pittsburgh, it's like now this year we're going to have two comedy festivals.
It's great.
And, you know, just there's, I mean, you know, when I go around the country and say, oh, you're from Pittsburgh, you know, and I'm like, how's the scene? And I'm like, well, we got 14 mics a week.
That's great.
You know, and it's exciting that you know, if I had anything to do with that, sure, whatever. But it's exciting, too, to like
not just whatever. I mean, you know, somebody has to be there to do that and to start
and,
that.
And making it a priority to like make it a community. You know what I mean? And that like, you know, people talk about rivalries between stand-ups. There's different clans of sharks and jets in different cities.
I'm
and
sure
like,
there are, but that doesn't matter at all.
That's, we all hang out.
Yeah.
Like we
that's
all
what's
do
great
shows.
About this festival. We're all hanging out together. Yeah. We're all sitting around. Well,
you know, the Pittsburgh scene, we all get along. We all put each other on shows. And there's stand-ups taking improv classes and improvisers taking stand-up classes.
I'm going to Orlando, and I'm going to do a workshop with comics. I'm going to do a workshop with improv people.
Yeah.
I love Pittsburgh. I don't know. Did I tell you that? I might have told you yesterday. For some reason, my younger brothers, they were their era of sports invincibility was the 70s. They lived in Florida at the time, uh-huh. and they didn't really, there was no teams. The Dolphins had won
right.
when they were too young. And so the Steelers and the Pirates are really big.
Right.
For me, Clemente is my all-time hero.
Yeah.
So we've always had a Pittsburgh affinity. You know, there's three cities in America that people shit on, which are three of the greatest cities in America. It's Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Pittsburgh.
I know.
Yeah, those three, great clubs, great music, great people.
Food.
Incredible food.
Oh, we have everybody from Europe making all their food.
And Pittsburgh is great. And I just did the Josh Gibson benefit down there, and for me, I just love Pittsburgh, and that's where we met originally.
Yeah.
Some benefit where there was more comedians than audience, I remember. Yeah. But anyway, so the fact that Pittsburgh is an artistic scene, there's a big artist scene, and thank God you created this thing, so be proud
well,
of
it's,
it.
It's, you know, and I go all around the country, and people are always like, I hate when people are like, oh, you're from Pittsburgh, sorry.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that old steel town, and I'm like... And what I'm trying to say is I think the arts and entertainment and comedy booming in Pittsburgh says a lot about its progression, because I think what I see happening now, you know, I tell people, I'm like, well, actually, we're getting one of the only Facebook headquarters in the world in Pittsburgh because of Carnegie Mellon. We also have one of the few Google headquarters in the world.
Interesting.
We now, because it's
three incredible bridges.
Yeah, right? I mean, a billion bridges, three rivers, you know.
Right,
but
that's what I meant, three
rivers.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. But now we have, like, healthcare and, you know, we have information technology. And
Pittsburgh's
like,
the new Canada.
Yeah, dude. People are calling us, you know, the new Austin, the new Portland, new San Francisco.
Austin is an incredible city.
Oh, yeah.
In so many ways.
I'm going in a week.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Oh, it's the greatest. Great clubs, great people, smart thinking.
But that's, you know, it's just saying that, like, you know, no, this is what's happening there now. And I think that the boom of comedy, I explain to people, it's because of these jobs in healthcare and the medical field, and also the young people coming in from all around the world, going to Carnegie Mellon University and working for Google and Facebook and all these information technologies. It's young, smart people. Young, smart people love arts.
Yes.
They do.
Yeah, you know, everyone loves art.
Yeah.
But the people who can appreciate stand-up in its purest form are mostly the smartest. The smartest people I know mostly are comedians.
Right.
Which is interesting shyest and that kind of thing. But I do think of it as a huge group, like a fraternity sorority of people who, you know, like I see a comic who's young and is really – we were talking last night about this woman who's like 22 in L.A. I've never seen her, and her name starts with an M, like Malcolm McDowell kind of a name, some young girl. And I was saying, you know, they said this person has it and she doesn't even know she has it yet. And I say, well, you go up to her and you let her know and help her along.
Yes.
And they were saying, yeah, that's what we do. We constantly – that's what we do for comedians. We you know, it's not a jealousy game. The people are jealous. It's going to be like that at any job.
Yeah, you can't be.
Yeah, like the sausage guy. He's, he's all like, hey, that guy has a bigger line at his sausage stand. It doesn't really matter. There are a lot of people who are famous who aren't really that talented. There's a lot of people who are very talented and not that famous. And you can't worry about any of that stuff. You just focus on being the best you can be.
Yeah. People always ask like, oh, well, I want to do this and
I
do
want
that.
A sausage now for some reason.
Yeah, I know. We had good sausage yesterday at cookout. It was pretty good.
And I'm a vegan and I ate it. That's how good it was. Yeah. It's true. But anyway, you were about to say.
No, I think it's – what?
What were you talking about? Oh, before that, about helping young people and
Oh, yeah. I always tell young comics because they're always like, oh,
you
helped
me with Kevin Spacey. I had to help you with
that one. Like, okay. People are like, you know, oh, like, what do I do? Blah, blah, blah. I just had this conversation outside with a bunch of comics. You know, I'm trying to get to know these people and network and blah, blah. I said, you know, look, I said, just my advice now is just broken down to be kind and be funny.
Yeah.
And I always say that at the end of this podcast. I'm like, look, be a good person. Say, please, thank you. You know, be a good person, or like, you know, be a good dude, be a good lady.
Yeah.
And then go be funny.
Right. Just be funny. And people will find you. If you're really funny, people will find you.
People try to find angles, and sure, there is business in networking.
Yes.
Sure. That's part of it's your business.
I understand it.
But at the end of the day, if you're a decent person to people around you, and you do your job on the mic, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. And you could be the nicest person in the world, and people are going to hate you because they hate themselves.
Yeah.
So they project that onto you, and you can't worry about that. You know, I used to want to be loved. That's one of the great reasons I do comedy.
Yeah, me too.
You know,
we're
fucked up people, the comics, and we want to be loved. And then, you know, and throughout my life, I've been booking different comedy things, and there are people who hate me, and they don't really know me, don't know that all I've done my whole life is work for the comedy industry to try to make it better. But
you hear that, Pittsburgh comedy?
Yeah, but here's the thing. You have to just be satisfied for yourself with it, and you put up with the naysayers because they're going to say nay.
Yeah.
That's what naysayers do. Yeah. And so you just don't worry about how other people feel. You be a nice person and but work hard.
Yeah.
You know, put the work hard. I was going to say ply and craft in a sentence, but I couldn't figure out how to put them together. But you get it.
Put the plywood together.
Yeah. Put
on the
plywood
craft table.
You know, on your craft motor boat. but anyway, you know what I'm saying. Just work your ass off. And that's what I do. I've been doing this comedy, like I said, almost 32 years in a row. And it's still exciting. I'm still high from last night, the two shows that we did and the beers we drank.
I know. That's fun. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So it's, I love to hear that. I really do. It's really valuable to hear that stuff. And I think a lot of people that listen it's really valuable, cool thing to hear.
The key is it's about letting go and getting out of your head. Because if you watch Nina Simone, and I always use her as an example, and it's funny because there's a lot of press about Nina Simone these days for good reason.
Yeah.
The great documentary by Liz Garbus. And now there's a new film coming out, another film. Nina Simone film. But when you watch her sing, she's just coming from her spirituality in her body. And I know it sounds corny, but it just comes from her soul.
Right.
And then you watch Celine Dion, who has an equally beautiful voice, and it's all in her head. And it's very, like I said earlier, paint by numbers, where, you know, there's no real soul to it. And then when I see comedians, you could tell when someone's up there just letting it go.
Right.
And then, like I said, there are people I watch Netflix half-hour specials where it's just people are painting by numbers and that there's no soul to it. But they might have a look, or they might have a kind of a style that's sellable.
We get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all right. And again, I don't root against these people.
Right.
I just notice that it's never going to get me up off my chair or get me to sit and watch for an hour.
Right.
But last night I saw, and this whole weekend, I've seen, you know, 10 or 12 people that have made me, you know, just like, oh, my God, this is what comedy is all about.
That's
exciting.
Awesome. This is the Grown Dad Business Podcast, and I'm going to back it up.
All right. I'm a dad.
Yeah. It's so knowing about how you are, like, professionally, and, you know, it's interesting to see where that came from. You know what I mean? Tell me about you grew up in New York.
Yeah, I was born in New York. Florida. I moved to Florida when I was just about 12. My parents got divorced. My mom remarried, and we moved to Florida from there.
Okay.
And my sister and I went with my mom and my stepfather, and then my mom had three kids with him.
Wow.
And my parents, you know, they were my dad's not around. My mom's still around. My mom's the funniest person I know. She still is hilarious, and she's the major influence in my life in the arts. Because my father worked all the time because we were a very, very poor family, and she took care of me, and instead of paying for babysitters, she would take me to concerts and Broadway plays.
Oh, wow.
And movies all the time. time, and we always laugh together and watch comedy together.
Yeah.
And we still do, you know, to this day. It's still really great. So she's influenced. And one of the moments that I'll never forget, and I've talked about this before on podcasts, is that my parents were going to see Buddy Hackett, who was my father's favorite comic.
Yeah.
And me and my sister and I were in the hotel room with the babysitter in Las Vegas, and they came up the stairs and through the door laughing, which was real. And to see them laughing, it's like, it was so fulfilling. But here's the interesting part. They had to see, they saw the show, they laughed their ass off, they got the bill, they paid it, they went through the lobby of the hotel, they went up the elevator and through the door, and they were still laughing.
Wow.
And I always wanted to make them laugh, and to, because they were always at odds, they were young kids.
Yeah.
And to, when I would make them laugh, they seemed like they were warmer and more human.
Right.
So that to me always was, okay, if I can be funny like that,
right,
that would mean a lot to
me. Yeah, that's I can definitely relate to a lot of that. I mean, my mom, we you know, I told you earlier, like, I come from a domestic violence background,
right,
and just a rough childhood, and then got out of that about 9 or 10 years old. And my mom was always still positive for us.
Mm.
You know, and I know she was going through a lot of pain, but to us, she was still fun and, you know, silly. And to this day, my mom is still, you know, she's now like, does like, you know, women's church groups, but then will still like in my ear be like, oh, that piece of shit.
Yeah.
Like, and say,
of course,
like, she's going to get mad because I said that.
Yeah.
Like, she'll be like, don't you tell people I don't. And then she'll say, don't you tell people. And then you little pissing off.
Yeah. But she probably loves it. You know, the thing is that you we're stronger because of who our parents are, or weaker because of who our parents are. And we want them to be right. And we want to look up to them. And we want them to show their vulnerability as well as their strength, because then we do the same thing. And I think that's why you become an artist, because, you know, I've had arguments with a few people about this, but most people agree that vulnerability is strength, and the sort of machismo
transparency.
Transparency is the best, but that sort of macho insecurity, that's what the sadness, that's where sadness, mostly the realm of sadness. So when you have a interesting situation, not always great, like divorces or, you know, domestic violence, you're going to see stuff on both ends of the spectrum.
Right.
And you're going to try to find your peace within that spectrum.
Yeah. And I love that like you said about your parents taking you to different, like, you know, entertainment things. And, and I remember my mom pretty much filled me with movies and music.
Yeah.
And, you know, cause we were kind of latchkey kids. I mean, you know, after leaving our stepdad, you know, my stepdad, like, my mom worked two jobs. She worked her ass off.
Yeah.
So we were kind of, me and my sister and I were latchkey kids, and why I early on fell in love with filmmaking. You know, I mean, I just watched everything. My other podcast is a movie podcast.
That's so great.
Yeah, You Can't Handle the Truth, movie review podcast.
What's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie of all time?
Yeah.
Goodfellas.
That's great. Mine's Cinema Paradiso.
Oh!
Yeah. And I love movies, and it's hard to make a top 10 list, but I can pick Cinema Paradiso. It's just, it's about film.
Yes.
It's a film about
love of film.
And love of film.
Wow, good pick.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. I went to every movie that I can go to.
Yep.
When we moved to Florida, my mom and my stepfather were so in love, they spent a lot of time together.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going with my mom all the time to the movies.
Right.
So I would go by myself, and I would even go to theaters and beg people to bring me in as their guardian so I can see movies like Mean Streets and other R-rated movies. And then I just said, fuck it, I got a job at a movie theater so I can see every movie in town. I'm a movie, you know, crazed nut.
Oh, yeah, that's all I do on the road.
Yeah.
That's all I do. I mean, well, besides the movie review podcast, because my partner is the Pittsburgh movie guy.
Ah.
Like, he's the critic. He does movie. He does radio, TV. And he's also like one of my openers. Like,
that's great.
He's a great, smart comic. And but I did the same thing similarly.
Yeah. We're making up words and stuff.
Yeah. Similarly. I was in the VHS era where it was just like my mom's working. We would go grocery shopping, stop at a spot, 5 movies, 5 days, $5.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going through just picking, like, you know, I've said this 100 times on the movie podcast, so if people are dual listeners, I apologize. But it's just, I remember being like 11, being like picking like drama, comedy, animated, you know, action. And my mom's like, why did you rent Dangerous Liaisons?
Yeah.
Like,
Because I want to see Uma Thurman.
I didn't know. I had no idea. I'm like, it was Michelle Pfeiffer's in that too or something.
I know.
And I'm like, I don't know. That's the chick from Scarface. And I like her. Like, you know what I mean?
You know what one of my favorite Michelle Pfeiffer films is? It has Rutger Hauer and has Matthew Broderick. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I can picture
Lady Hawk with a
Lady
the
Hawk.
End of it.
Oh my god,
that's
gosh.
One of the most brilliant films ever. One of the greatest stories ever, Lady Hawk. Very underrated. And you know, but three incredible actors.
Ooh, I gotta watch that again.
Yeah,
But that's where I was, and my mom really embraced. She knew I needed an escape,
right?
And her growing up, going through abuse,
right?
Twice she went through it. For God's sakes,
right. And sometimes people find love in abuse because that's how you were loved by your parents. So then you search out for that and you think you deserve it. And that's why the message has to be clear that you don't deserve it. And
it is.
Yeah.
But my mom grew up as like a cool, fun little hippie chick, just obsessed with music. So she understood an escape in the arts.
Yeah,
you know, and so her just being like, of course you can buy comic books. Of course you can rent any movie you want. You know what I mean? Like, and my mom handing me a Scorpions tape.
Yeah, that's pretty
handing
good.
Handing me AC/DC, like getting me AC/DC Back in Black for my 10th birthday.
She's hip.
You know, so cool.
Yeah.
Like her record collection.
My mom took me to see Ike and Tina Turner, which today is still one of the greatest concerts I've ever seen.
Wow.
I've seen a lot of great concerts. I saw Queen and Thin Lizzy together. That was incredible.
Oh my God, I can't handle that.
Queen
is one of my all-time favorites.
And they were incredible live. And I'm 57 now, so in 1976, I graduated high school. In that part of the 70s, Queen was really at the form. And then when I went to college, like I guess it was 77, I went to see Queen and Thin Lizzy, two of the greatest guitar players of all time, Steve Moore and Brian May in the same building. But anyway, so music is so important. And around my house, there was always music going on. We were singing, we were dancing. You know, one of the things about the Letterman show is the comedians got to choose the song they came out to.
Oh, cool.
And the other guests didn't. They could have, but they mostly, Paul was so brilliant, and he would pick something that had to relate to the movie that the guest was plugging or something about the guest. But the comedians would pick the song. And
you kind of understand that.
Yeah, and it was great because sometimes it would be the theme. Like I did one set all about lying, and I had Lies by the Knickerbockers. I write some music, and I had them play one of my songs to come out to, which was really so surreal. But I didn't hear it because I was so into, like, nervous and let's get this down. But I played a couple of them play a couple of times songs that my mom and I grew up dancing to.
Oh, wow.
Like Barbara George, I know, you don't love me no more. And I had the band play that, and they loved it. It was a great old song. But my mom was just like so touched. She said, that's our song from when we were, you know, growing up. And then Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow and, you know, all that. Anyway, music is so important. And comedy is very musical. Comedy is the same rhythms, the same mathematical rhythms as comedy, as music.
I agree. Yeah. I always say, like, you know, I've done musicals in high school and stuff, but I can beatbox, I can dance, and I understand rhythm. And then when you start doing stand-up or any kind of comedy, you feel that rhythm pretty easily. You know what I mean? Like, it's really fun. But, yeah, the arts is just being able to live in that world, you know, and just go somewhere else. I think my mom understood that. And it's neat that your parents kind of understood the joy that brings.
Yes.
And we do the same thing now. We play music in our house. You know, my kids are, you know, we talk about movies and play movies and, you know, and it's so fun, you know.
And so important to pass it on.
Yeah. So, like, from what it sounds like, your parents were pretty fun and supportive and loving people.
Yeah. My mom more than my dad at the time when we were young, because he was always working. He was too young to really... you know, want to be a parent, I think. And he wasn't really around that much. But we got very close before he died, which was really cool that worked out for me. But my mom has always been supportive. And then she met my stepfather and fell in love, and we moved to Florida. And they had three kids right away. And that was, you know, really fun and really cool. Yeah.
And how old were you when they got married and had kids?
It was 1970, so I was 11, about to be 12 later that year. So my the twins were born in 1971.
Twins.
And then
a middle school boy with twins.
Yeah, twin brothers. And then they had another kid in 1974. Now in 1974, when my brother was born, my stepfather got cancer.
Oh, wow.
And so the baby was just born, David. And then, so the twins were three, and the little baby was just born. And my sister, who was still around, was, I guess, 11 and I was 15.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, my stepfather gets cancer. He has to go to the hospital. And he lived there pretty much for a year with cancer and, you know, back and forth to the house, but mostly in the hospital. And my mom was always with him. So now all of a sudden, I'm the parent. I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
And I'm raising the kids. Wow. And I have to raise all the kids together. So now, you know, and then my stepfather died in 1975, like a year later.
Wow.
So to my littlest brother, I'm really the only father figure that he really knew.
Wow.
You know, there were other men that came along that were really terrific in his life. But, you know, to me, the little one, he's almost like my son.
Wow.
More than anything. All the kids are like my son. And I've actually had to separate myself and say, look, I have to tell myself, look, I can't be their father. I'm their brother, and I have to be their fun brother and not
right.
I have to catch myself every once in a while to stop trying to be a parent, but I raise them and I have that sort of instinct with them.
Right.
But I've turned them on to music and film.
Right.
And my brothers are musical and love movies and and intensely in
so
the arts.
And so that did kind of did that play a part? I mean, when your stepfather passed away, you know, it's like you kind of still had that foundation of their kind of fun love and
they really,
you know,
loved
love
each
for
other.
The arts. And
it was great.
So did that kind of help you guys keep it together and have fun? And
yeah, I think so. I think that the great thing about my family is a lot of love in it. As dysfunctional as every family is, and mine is completely dysfunctional.
Yeah.
A lot of yelling and screaming and mixed religions and you know, all that kind of stuff. But we definitely have or had an incredible love that we still carry on today. We care for each other, and it's very, very deep. And we've been through hell because I've lost a sister. My sister died young at 34, and then one of the twins died.
He was
35, and this was only a few years ago. And so we've really gotten even tighter through the grief that comes with that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And then again, how do you laugh? How do you continue going on? Well, you got to laugh. You got to continue doing the arts. You got to continue.
Right.
You'll never get over stuff, but you will be able to live in the spirit of those people. First time I did Letterman as a guest, as a comic, my sister had just died, and I was like, I wish she was here to see this. But I brought her on stage with me, in a sense, when I first did the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, you can get through this tough life. You can either play the victim, which is very easy to do, and I did that a lot in my life, but I won't do that anymore. I won't allow myself to play the victim. Instead, I decided that I'm, you know, going to make myself have an incredible life in the time that we have together.
Right. Wow. All right. So that is part one of my podcast with Eddie Brill. Return next week, guys. Because the podcast will return with part two of Eddie Brill, getting more into his family life and more comedy stuff. Really exciting. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being my friend, guys. So get back into Grown Dad Business next week for part two of Eddie Brill. Be kind and be fun.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.